Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Today, my guest is Frances Harding, whose wonderful novels have been nominated for the Guardian Award, the Gitche's, the Carnegie Mellon, and whose Fly By Night has won the Branford Bose Award. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Her last novel was Cuckoo Song, a frightening, fantastic, changeling story. And her latest is the equally intriguing The Lie Tree, which I absolutely loved. She's a writer I was admittedly quite late to discover, but so very glad to have discovered. Frances, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you very much.
Now, The Lie Tree is your seventh novel in, what, 10 years or so?
Yes. I'm not the fastest writer. I'm aware that some do turn out a book a year. I seem to manage generally about a book every year and a half.
Well, I was going to be very impressed and say that's a pretty short time to have produced so many highly praised and loved books. Does it feel like a short time to you, though, or does it just feel like this is what you've always been doing?
Well, I've always been writing, but the period where I've actually been published, that portion of my life, no, those years seem to have raced past. I think this is partly a symptom of the fact that I'm a little older than I was, and years get a bit shorter anyway.
They do, don't they? I find that as well.
They don't make them the same way they used to. We get these cheap knockoff years that wear out really quickly.
Now, you've set The Lie Tree in Victorian England. I feel like this gave you this wonderful opportunity to explore women's roles in society at the time. Though I suppose, of course, there are plenty of times in history when you could have set a story about a young girl who's struggling in a way with societal limitations. What was it about the story that made you pick a Victorian setting? Or was it the other way around? Did the setting come first?
The idea actually came first. Originally, the notion of the lie tree as this plant that feeds upon lies and produces fruit that contains secrets, that popped into my head first, actually while I was taking a 10-mile hike. And originally, I was planning to play it completely straight. I was thinking about putting together some sort of a fantasy setting and running the idea of the lie tree without any ambiguity. But at the point where I started to talk to Macmillan and they suggested that maybe I should think about another historic fantasy setting, since they'd been very pleased with the way I'd done Cuckoo Song, as soon as I started thinking of it in that context, the Victorian period occurred quite forcibly to mind, because I was looking for a time when there was a quest for truth, but at the same time, lies and facades were extremely important and powerful. And so I wanted to pick a time when there were certain treasured inaccuracies that people would cling to with desperation, and certain truths that would be shattering and unthinkable.
And of course, one of the great big truths that was shattering and unthinkable was Darwin's theory of evolution that plays in with this book. I love this idea of the scientists who were also men of God and them trying to figure out where they were going to go with this. Did you have to do a lot of research into this, into what the reactions were at that time of people?
Quite a lot. And in this, I was helped a great deal by a good friend of mine. Originally, before I'd started to research, I was going to make the heroine's father a professor, because I had this notion that science had to be quite a lot like we have it now. And I had preconceptions about there being hard divisions between men of religion, men of science, etc. Because that's a natural assumption for us in this day and age. But I met up with this friend of mine who had an archaeological background, and she was able to set me straight about a lot of things. And when I described the setup for the book, I said, well, okay, what is this? What's this natural scientist, this father of my heroine, like to be? And one of the first things she said was, well, he's probably a clergyman. It hadn't even crossed my mind. And of course, that made a lot of his dilemmas, a lot of his psychological situations and motivations a lot more potent and intricate, because he is in the overlap between men of science and men of God who are facing this really quite traumatic revelation.
Now, you've said that there was a single image or the single thought of the lie tree, this monstrous plant that sort of grows on lies and needs nothing else except those lies to grow, that you started off with that. And now, of course, the book became much bigger. And as we were just talking about the kind of Victorian setting that comes into play and all the things that come along with it. But yet, is there a moment or a point in that story that stayed with you the most even now? Was it the tree, or was there something else that sort of took over as the thing that you will hold sort of dearest to you when you're done with the story?
To a large extent, certainly while I was writing it, my characters upstaged the tree. Certainly their interactions. There are certain scenes, quite painful scenes, between some of the characters that ultimately felt more potent to me than my extremely sinister tree. Because to a certain extent, the tree is almost an expression and projection of a lot of other things that are going on. Certainly as a dark force, in some respects, my heroine actually starts to upstage the tree in some places, which is an odd thing to say about one's heroine.
But she's really quite something. I really enjoyed her. I especially enjoyed the relationship that she had with her mother. Having been a terrible dean, I completely related to that. But what I really enjoyed is that how, you know, in the beginning, she and her mother Myrtle, and I'm not going into spoiler territory right now, I'm just still sticking to generalizations, they're sort of perfect foils for each other. But before you know what's going on, Faith is becoming more and more like her mother, being able to manipulate the people around her when she needs to get something done. And she really believes in it. I enjoyed that a great deal. Your female characters are always, in all the books of yours that I've read, wonderfully complex. And there's such incredible growth possible for the young teenage women, right? At the beginning of the book, you know that they've got this big trajectory that they could follow. And there is a lot of growth for them in the course of one book. How much of this trajectory do you plan out, say, for your lead protagonist? And how much of it becomes them taking over from whatever scary situation that you've put them in?
There's always an element of both. I do plan. I'm sometimes asked if I'm a planner or a pantser, if I plan or if I fly by the seat of my pants. I am a planner, but I don't plan everything. I know all the significant things that are going to happen. I know where things are going to end. And this is true both for the plot and for the main character trajectory. But there will still be things and revelations and moments that surprise me, which is a good thing, because otherwise I'd find it really boring. Such things should be partly a journey of exploration and discovery for the writer as well as the reader. But I'm glad that you do like my female characters, because what I definitely didn't want to do with this book is, well, Faith is in some respects a girl ahead of her time, though very much in some respects psychologically hampered and shackled by her time. For her, you know, I wanted to show that rebellion is not easy. Even deciding to rebel, making that jump, really not easy. But what I definitely didn't want to do was use the other women in the book as contrast to show how great Faith is. I didn't want to make them in comparison look like sheep or docile figures or non-entities. So part of what I wanted Faith's trajectory to represent was a growing understanding and appreciation of the other women around her, so that they actually start coming into focus for the reader as well as the book progresses. I wanted to look at the fact that, in spite of the fact that she is quite an unusual girl to the start, unsurprisingly, she's got quite a few gender assumptions herself. I mean, of course she has. And starting to actually get past that is part of what she goes through during the course of the book.
And none of the other women were just there as background. They're all quite complex. And even the ones you think are not that deep towards the end, and again, no spoilers, but a lot of them come up, you find out things about them and you think, oh, right, that's what's been going on. So I love that. I love that slow discovery of the female characters, not just of Faith, but of Myrtle, of the others as well. Particularly Myrtle, I do admit I had a soft spot for her. She worked so hard, that woman. She really did. But now tell me, what draws you to the setting, to the settings, rather, of your books? And you know, when they're set in the real world, if I can call it that, it's always in a time other than our own. The Lightree is set in Victorian England. Cuckoo Song was set in the 1920s. And as you said, your publishers were very happy with Cuckoo Song and they wanted to do a historical novel again. Is that something that sort of came naturally to you the first time? Is it something you're going to go back to? Do you feel comfortable with that?
Well, I do have a fascination with history. Even my fantasy settings, you can see it. Fly by Night and its sequel, Twilight Robbery, are both... Well, there's a lot of influence woven into them, but they're partly based on England at the start of the 18th century. I mean, there's a lot of other influences as well. Romania, a particular holiday to Romania was very influential. And of course, my own crazed imagination. But whenever I go to a place, I will always be fascinated by its history because for me, that is part of understanding the place. You don't understand where you are until you understand how you got there. So that comes fairly naturally. I did find with Cuckoo Song and with the Lie Tree that the research was considerably harder because, of course, when one's designing one's own world,
yes,
like the world of the Fractured Realm for Fly By Night, one can be inconsistent, but one can't be wrong. One can be illogical, but one cannot have actually made a historical mistake. Whereas, of course, when you're setting something in the real world, you can. And there were a lot of last-minute panics and realizations that I'd made horrible or silly errors, some of which I'm sure nobody else would have noticed, but which I would have known were there. And I'm sure there are still some still lurking, waiting to ambush and shame me, but I think I've hoovered up the worst of them. Oh, for example, I ended up swearing at my screen due to the difficulties of hiding a nine-year-old girl in a 1920s car's boot. I assumed they'd have boots, but they had, in fact, these big sort of boxes strapped on the back. And if you have a small nine-year-old girl and you fold her quite carefully, it's quite hard to fit them in those. So I had to rethink a portion of the book.
But you managed. I think you did quite well, remarkably well, given that cars had no boots.
Thank you.
Now, writing for children versus writing for young adults, your work fits into this sort of, for me, rather wide age bracket. I know I keep reading about how it's middle grade, but that doesn't sort of encapsulate it enough for me. Now, it's always a good thing in my mind, of course, to have a wide age readership, but I do wonder if it makes it harder for you as a writer to sort of know how far you can go with each book. I mean, is there ever a fear that something perhaps is too dark for younger readers or not complex enough for the older readers? Or do you just sort of leave that aside and write the story that you have to write and let the publishers worry about everything else?
Mainly the latter. When I'm asked who I'm writing for, my usual answer is that I'm writing for 12-year-old me. And 12-year-old me was quite a strange little girl. I have a lot of respect for younger readers. I think they can handle a lot of darkness. I think they can handle a lot of complexity. I think they are often better than adults at working out the meaning of a word from context or just coping, even if it is a little obscure. They're a bit more practiced at that than we are. We get lazy. So I don't tend to dumb down much. Funnily enough, when I was quite young, actually I think about 7, I left a message for older me to the effect of, remember this, I am not stupid. I know adults think I am, but I'm not. So I have always remembered this message, and I try to honour this and not make assumptions about younger readers. You've mentioned that I've been classed as middle grade and sometimes as YA. People don't really know what to do with me. I don't particularly mind. It does mean that I tend to get invited to the middle grade conferences and the YA conferences, so that's all rather nice. Basically, I write my book for anybody who can enjoy reading it, and I am certainly not going to judge them based on their age.
I do love that you don't pander to your younger readers. I think that's very obvious in your writing, and that's partly for me the appeal in your writing, partly, of course, many things that I like in your writing. One of the things that I like is that you are obviously not pandering to the younger audience. I also love the fact that the adult characters in your books don't always have it together. You know, I have a 7-year-old daughter. We read a lot of books, and the adults are always the people saving the kids. And that does it at some point. For sure, she's 7 right now. It makes sense. But I know at some point she will want to explore what it's like to be an adult who doesn't have it together. So I enjoy that in your books a great deal. The adults are fallible. They're vulnerable. They're often struggling themselves. Is this something that you are very conscious about putting into the novels?
Yes, very much so. I do want the adults to actually be characters. And adults don't always have it together. In fact, let's face it, most of the time we don't at all.
We're just pretending.
Absolutely, absolutely. We learn to bluff. Adulthood is the great game. But I think, middle grade is a bit of an arbitrary term, but I think it is very much the age where younger readers are becoming more acutely aware of the fact that the adults and their parents, and by extension, a lot of the authority figures in charge of the world, do not necessarily have it together and are not necessarily right about things. and that their own opinions are actually often as valid.
I keep reading about how you end up tired of the book that you're writing. I read a bunch of interviews with you yesterday, and so many of them you said that you just get sick of the book, you're done with, you're hating it, you want to move on. Do you ever forgive them, the books that you've hated? Do you ever love them again?
Yes, but usually only around about publication time. This terrible stage fright before publication, because I have worked myself in a state of hating the book. When I say I hate the book, I don't mean that I'm thinking, gosh, I'm so tired of this. It's not even that I think it's not any good. It's a deep soul knowledge that it is no good, that everyone is going to hate it, that it's going to disappoint everybody who's looking forward to it, and that this is going to be the moment when they all find me out for the imposter I am. And even though I go through this every single time, well, pretty much every time, it's still just as convincing a force in my head. And so when it comes out and people actually show some signs of not hating it, first there's surprise and disbelief, and then I gradually start forgiving it for existing again. And when people start to enthuse or show affection for particular parts or aspects of the book, I'm suddenly reminded, oh, yes, that is why I put that in. That was the idea. That's the reaction people were supposed to have. And it's this process of rediscovery. I'm sorry, that all sounds quite mad, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. It sort of makes sense because, I mean, I can see where you're coming from. You're working on a book. You're working on this same thing, with these same people, imaginary people who you've made up in your head. You're in this setting for about a year. It can be, I'm sure, lonely and difficult to be in that constantly.
Indeed. We have a very bizarre job. We write in a void. We are doing something where nobody is checking up on us. We're not getting feedback. We can fall into second-guessing ourselves rampantly. And in my case, I'm very dependent on and very grateful for writers' groups. I've got one or two writers' groups that I belong to that meet semi-regularly, quite small, featuring friends of mine, where I get feedback, which is absolutely invaluable, but also a deadline. Because, well, I when people ask me about the best and worst things about being a writer, one of the answers I give to both questions is the freedom. Because on the one hand, it's lovely, it's fantastic, it's great that if I want, I can jump on a, I can walk out now and go for a walk in the beautiful weather. Or I can jump on a train and go into the centre of London and go through the, you know, relatively non-crowded museums and do some research there, or anything I feel like, or meet up a friend with a friend for lunch, or decide that I want to go to nip off to another part of the country or something to check out something else, and nobody can stop me. I don't need to book holiday ahead, and that's all great. On the other hand, you don't have anyone checking on you. You have to be very self-disciplined, and that's not something that comes as naturally to me as it does to some other writers. I'm better than I used to be, but I find that having miniature deadlines actually helps a lot, because you do not want to have to end up writing a 100,000-word book at the last moment.
I find this quite interesting that Frances Harding, on her 7th book in 10 years, still goes to a writer's group. Is this like a professional? You know, is everyone else in it a professional as well? Because if everyone else in it is amateur and you're in your 7th novel, I promise you, they're really resentful that you're using them for deadlines this way.
On the contrary, they're really lovely. I'm very lucky. I've got very nice friends. One of my groups is with another published author who actually is considerably more experienced than me and has a longer backlist than I am. That's my friend Rhiannon Lassiter, who is also responsible for having advised me to try writing a children's book in the first place.
So we'll blame her for everything.
Sorry?
We'll blame her for everything.
We'll thank her for everything. And she's the person who basically, when I was writing this first children's book, told me that I ought to submit. And she's the person who, when I had told her that, I've got 5 chapters, but this was only an experiment and it was no good and it was destined for an unmarked grave. She's the person who stole my 5 chapters from me and took them to her editor, which resulted in me getting a book contract, to my great surprise. So to a large extent, I owe my career to Rhiannon. She's a very, very good friend and also gives very, very good feedback. But my other friends also, fantastic feedback. And although they're not published, the quality of their writing is very good, and the quality of their analysis is excellent as well.
Did you really grow up in a series of creepy old houses, as all your bios keep saying? Do their ghosts still show themselves in your books so many years later?
I grew up in a series of small, sinister villages, most of them English, one Welsh. There was one particular creepy old house that I did live in, which you wouldn't believe it if you'd seen it. It was on the top of the hill. It was grey. It was not quite partially ruined, but it did have a sort of battlement-like top and stone peacocks on the roof and a rather sinister-looking stone eagle. And there were some ruined walls in the grounds, some of them massively overgrown and with nettles clustering in what used to be the doorways, and a little woodland nearby. So, yes, quite a surreal sort of a place. And there actually was a sort of wuthering, moaning sound that occurred whenever the wind blew. It used to really freak out guests. So I don't think anyone could be surprised that I ended up with an interest in the Gothic. I think under the circumstances, I never stood a chance.
Now, tell me about hats. I noticed in the little brief video exchange that we had before this that you were wearing a hat in the house. And is
yep.
there one hat that you want to tell me about? Jonathan Howard asks over Twitter whether this one particular hat has a really sinister history, and if it doesn't, could you please make one up?
I nearly always wear a hat. I've always loved hats. Even the baby photos of me have me wearing a hat. But I started wearing a hat any chance I got from the age of about 16, though back then it was a little peaked cap, sort of Oliver Twist style hat. Black, obviously. And I wore hats of that style through university and out the other side. It was at a point during my 20s that the hat of being Francis changed from being a little cap to being either a fedora or a trilby. Sometimes it's a fedora, sometimes it's a trilby, but always that slightly sort of 1930s, 40s, 50s style of black gangsterish hat. I think that's partly because when I was growing up, I saw an awful lot of 30s and 40s films and loved them, particularly noir and the detective vehicles. So I saw an awful lot of the Mr. Moto films and The Thin Man and The Saint and The Falcon. And you get the idea. All of those. They were all showing about 6 p.m. in the afternoon, just after we got back from school. And I loved them. So for me, those hats have associations with a certain amount of style, mystery, adventure, danger, and all the rest of that. And why wouldn't you want something like that in your life? Now, it's not always the same hat because I wear them continually, which means that weather happens. They bleach in the sun. They have rain falling on them a lot. Sometimes the little bands around them wear out or discolour, etc. So they get replaced by another hat of being Francis. But I can't throw away the old ones because by then I've bonded with them. So I have a little retirement village of slightly tired trilbies and fedoras and Oliver Twist caps. I sort of think of the role of the hat of being Francis as being very much a role rather than individual hat, a bit like Doctor Who. So you get a succession of hats playing the role and each bringing something new to it. But, you know, it's always still the same role. Currently the hat of being Francis has a little feather tucked into the band, which is its quirk, its equivalent of a Doctor Who fez or bow tie. Of course, this is the boring answer to the hat question.
But what I want to know is, when you see a hat you like, do you buy more than one?
It sometimes happens. I do have more hats that are entirely healthy. And they're quite varied because I have some interesting hobbies, some of which involve dressing up in period clothing, all the rest of it. I used to be a historically an actor, for one thing. So as well as all the fedoras and trilbies, I have straw boaters and Regency bonnets and 18th century bonnets, and you get the idea.
But is there a sinister history?
Well, another far, far better explanation for the hat problem is, so the hat question, is that, in fact, the hat is the only sapient entity here. It's the hat you're talking to. And in fact, the rest is just a bipedal construct that the hat controls and uses to walk it around the place and communicate with other bipeds and in some way infiltrate human society.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was about to ask you if, you know, we'd have a book soon or eventually that basically was about a sentient hat. I think you just gave me that book.
Well, the thing is, you see, if I did write it, because the way my brain works, I'd be looking at that and I think, yes, but that's not really enough for a story. And then sinister milliners would creep in, and there'd have to be a rationale for the sapience of the hat. And then I start wondering about other hats and whether they could be in some way awakened or liberated. And then I'd start thinking about factions and whether you'd have these boater bonnet wars. And then I'd start to wonder if perhaps there'd been a history of powerful... You see, this is how my plots get complicated.
Francis,
I need to stop talking now.
I don't see the problem in any of this. What's the problem here? I don't see that. I mean, this sounds great. Please, go ahead. I have no issues with any of this. I don't know how many people listening have problems with this. Really, we see no problems. But moving on from the hats, Elliot has also sent a question in over Twitter, and she wants to know about your novel for adults. What's the secret novel for adults?
Well, it's not very secret. There's been a press release about it. This is for Saga Press, who are part of Simon & Schuster, and I'm rather looking forward to this. It's going to be an urban fantasy set in London, and I know that there are a lot of urban fantasies set in London. However, London is sufficiently complex, interesting, and rich that I'm hoping I can still carve out my own little niche here. It will be focused around some ideas concerning the knowledge, you know, the knowledge that the London cab drivers have to learn, and there will be a number of alternative Londons, and I'll probably leave it at that, I'm afraid.
Thanks to A Face Like Glass, I'm a bit fascinated with this idea of cheese that can give you visions. I've been trying to spend quite a bit of time recently, I admit, thinking about what sort of cheese would give me what sort of vision. Please tell me that you actually have a list of what to expect when to eat certain sorts of cheese.
I'm afraid not. I do not have the ultimate catalogue for vision inducement in cheeses. In Face Like Glass, of course, a lot of my cheeses I think pretty much all my cheeses were fictional. So I was enthusiastically and happily inventing my own cheeses. In terms of real world cheeses, I can't do that. Though I did have fun looking into some of the more bizarre cheeses that do exist in this world, some of which I have to admit I might not actually want to eat, enthusiastic as I am about cheese.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I believe there are cheeses with maggots in them. I'm fine with the fungus. I'm fine with the fungus. I can handle the blue. But I don't know about this stuff like crawling around in it. I don't know about that.
Absolutely. That was actually the one I was thinking of. I think it's actually illegal in some countries on health and safety grounds. But yes, these are special jumping maggots. They can actually sort of jump a reasonable distance, which doesn't, as far as I'm concerned, make it all that much better.
I'm also fascinated by the idea that something you read unsanctioned can drive you mad. I think that's wonderful. That's something that sort of, in a way, exists in our world, I suppose, if I want to be a little dramatic about it. Have you ever read a book and felt that it could do that? Something so powerful that it stayed with you and sort of broke open your mind and put things back together again?
Well, quite often. That's what they're for. I mean, books should be mind-altering substances, whether it's fiction or non-fiction. They should break apart and rearrange our ideas of how the world works. They should kick aside our complacencies. They should force empathy upon us. That's absolutely what they're for. There's quite a few books that in different ways did that when I was very young. In fact, they're books that I remember extremely fondly because they did that.
So what are you reading nowadays? Is there something you've read that's done that for you recently?
Well, I actually read quite a mix. I tend to read middle grade and YA and adult fiction. Recently, my reading has been rather dominated by the fact that for quite a few months, I was helping to judge The Kitches. So I ended up reading about 60 books.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, my pleasure.